been a real pleasure to be here. And now there's some cell biologists here, finally, so this is great, too. And I think the point of this is supposed to be a 8-week conference on evolution of the cell. For me, as an evolutionary biologist, the cell is like the last great frontier. I mean, it's kind of bizarre when you think about it. In evolutionary biology, we've worked on the evolution of the outward phenotype for forever, since the beginning. And now we have a rich field of molecular evolution. We have a pretty good emerging field of genomic evolution. Everybody who likes to work on multicellular things got excited a few years ago about EvoDevo, so now we have EvoDevo, which may or may not be called a science. But we jumped right over the cell. It's kind of a strange, really strange situation because, you know, the building blocks are in the cell. And so I think this meeting might make some sense. I mean, I guess that's part of the issue. Does it make sense or not? And what would it take to develop an evolutionary cell biology? Because at least from the standpoint of evolutionary biology, there isn't one. Us evolutionary biologists don't know anything about cells.
Can you explain why the cell was skipped over?
No, I can't. Well, maybe one reason is we don't know anything about cells. You know, evolutionary biologists sort of, I think the general assumption, you know, other than the fact that genes are down there in the nucleus, if you work on a eukaryote, the internal aspects of cells aren't really constraining the outward phenotypes of organisms. I'm going to argue against that in a few minutes, but I think that's the general feeling in the field. I mean, most evolutionary biologists work on, or field biologists, or at least that's the orientation, and they work on natural selection operating in the outward phenotype of organisms. And the tendency, I think, and there's not a whole lot of other evolutionary biologists in the room, there's a few, I guess, but so I guess I could say anything, and you wouldn't know if there were a conflict, but I think it's fairly fair to say that it's part just a history of the field. So that's the first point here. This is a pointer, isn't it? This little thing. Is it important? Is what goes on inside a cell really important to the questions that most evolutionary biologists ask? Adaptation in response to the external environment of the organism. So that's what this is all about. Do the internal workings of cells constrain the outward evolution of phenotypes of organisms? This is just a statement I wanted to make. Most of us coming through here work on eukaryotes. Prokaryotes seem to be all about metabolic diversity. I mean, it's just amazing. If you look at the prokaryotic world, just about every metabolic invention that you can think of is present in some prokaryote. A lot of what eukaryotes are about extension of this, and we're for the most part more restricted metabolically than the whole prokaryotic world, for sure. But most of what we seem to be about is more evolution of elaborations at the morphological and structural level. And that's, I think, largely what this meeting is sort of about. At least so far, there hasn't been a whole lot about details of metabolism. So this is just another couple of observations. I think one of the most important things here is just if there is going to be the emergence of an evolutionary cell biology, or at least if we're to figure out if there can be, I think education is important. In some sense, that's what this meeting is really good for, I think. Because as I said already, you know, most evolutionary biologists just don't worry about the insides of cells. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of cell biologists don't have a deep training in evolutionary biology. One thing that I think is great about this field is this, that evolutionary biology, for those of you who aren't aware of it, is it's got a very, very sophisticated mathematical theoretical basis. It's as mathematical as any other field in biology, with the exception perhaps of biophysics. And here we have, you know, a room full of biophysics types. So biology, a quantitative science. So this is a pretty, we're already, you know, to the starting blocks in the sense that at least a good fraction of individuals in both fields are not scared to death of mathematics, which is not true of a lot of biologists. Okay, so I'm going to break this up into three general points, sets of points. What would be the observational starting points? You know, just the basic descriptive field of cell biology. What do we need to know to get an evolutionary cell biology going? What are the key theoretical questions that evolutionary biologists might contribute to? And then finally, could this be turned into an empirical science in terms of doing experiments in evolutionary biology? And this connects back to what Dave was talking about yesterday. Okay, so observational points. I mean, I view the cell as, my formal training was initially in ecology, community and population ecology. And to me, in some sense, the cell biology is sort of like ecology, community and population ecology. There's a natural history of the components of cells and how proteins interact. I mean, it's not conceptually that different than competition and predator-prey interactions and so on at the level of ecology. And if we want to understand how cellular constituents evolve, we really need to know who sees each other. You can't have coevolution of different proteins if they're never talking to each other. They never see each other in the cell at the same time. And you know, oftentimes when we do just crude things like yeast to hybrids, things stick together. Doesn't mean they ever see each other in the cell. So you know, I view this as sort of the early, in evolutionary cell biology at this point would be sort of the early stages of traditional evolutionary biology, natural history. One major limitation that I see here is we need to have a good comparative cell biology. So I think this has been one of the big limitations of the meeting so far, is that you know we have a topic and we have one or two people on the topic, and we all work on our favorite organisms, and so there hasn't been a real major diversity of phylogenetic context of various questions we've been asking. And so if we don't have a good comparative cell biology, which is just basic description of how organisms differ, it's very difficult to know what the questions would even be in evolutionary cell biology. If we don't know about the diversity that's evolved, we don't even know what the questions are. And I do want to emphasize that comparative biology is not evolutionary biology. Evolutionary biology is concerned, it's a basis for many of the questions we asked. But you can do comparative biology with zero knowledge of evolution. And people did it for many centuries before Darwin was in some sense. What we're concerned with in evolutionary biology are the mechanisms by which biodiversity arose.
I think also like it's not just about knowing you know what has evolved, but you also need to think a little bit about what hasn't evolved. You know, if every organism is the same in some way, that's also an interesting question. How else could it have been, and why isn't it that way?
That's a real good point. In fact, I'll return to that a little bit with the bringing in the theory. Is there just certain things that just are not possible in a population genetic context? And if you don't think about evolution in a population genetic way, it's hard to appreciate what is and what isn't possible. And then I want to emphasize with a few examples is there we need to keep in mind there's a fundamental distinction between the mechanisms that gave rise to led to the emergence of a cellular modification and a natural selection subsequent ability to use it for other things. So what a particular cellular embellishment is used for today in a multicellular organism may have nothing whatsoever to do with why it emerged in the unicellular ancestor of all of us eukaryotes. And that tends to get forgotten, I think, sometimes, and we'll see a few good examples of that. The other thing that I think is quite extremely valuable here in terms of developing this field is this down here, is the ability that you guys have to make measurements of phenotypes within cells at the chemical, physical level even. At a level we just don't do at outward phenotypes of organisms. If you know what the molecules are actually doing inside a cell, you really know the context of the measurement you're making. It's very, very common, as I think all of you know, for people studying thinking they're studying adaptation, to the external environment is you look at a phenotype of an organism, and we have this tendency to make up stories. What's the most likely explanation for the external evolutionary forces that led to this plumage pattern on a bird, or color pattern on a fish, or predator-prey strategies, and so on? And often this is done in a very, very uncritical way. So what I think is really great about cell biology is if you really understand, I mean, we're down at a pretty low level, and if you really understand the mechanisms by which proteins are interacting and where they are and so on, you can really measure phenotypes in, I think, a pretty meaningful way. I guess no cell biologist would argue with that one. But in a more meaningful way that's often possible without, you know, a lifetime study of Darwin's finches in the Galapagos or something. Okay, so here's another basic question in the area of observation. How often at the cellular level is structural homology, and this is relates back to the whole comparative biology thing, not matched by orthology of the underlying genetic architecture? In other words, how often is it that we see, say, in a land plant and an animal, intracellular embellishment that we think is shared by common ancestry, doing the same thing, but are the constituents actually encoded by the genes that are orthologous? There can be convergence on the same intracellular embellishment, and there can be gene replacement over time. So you could start with a particular thing like the nuclear pore, for example, and you have various duplications of genes, which we now know go on at a very, very high rate in all organisms. And you've got a temporary phase of redundancy that you can use more than one protein, and then you lose the original one, and suddenly you've got what's really the same structure but has a different genetic basis. How often does this occur? Probably the most dramatic example to think about would be animals versus land plants. We animals and fungi are on one side of the root of the phylogenetic tree of eukaryotes. Land plants are on the other side. So if you look inside the cell and certainly inside the genome, there's many commonalities. Of course, we're quite different in many ways. There aren't a lot of land plants in here giving seminars, but a lot of things are convergence. For example, intron number. Land plants are chock full of introns. We animals are chock full of introns, but most of the surrounding lineages of us are pretty intron depauperate. And I would argue that it's just the population genetic environment that we share with land plants. With both large organisms, random genetic drift plays a large role. It makes it easy for mobile elements and introns to colonize genomes. So that's a convergent sort of thing. It's not because of common inheritance. And just a couple other quick examples. Histones. We all know that histones are the most conserved of all proteins in eukaryotes. I think we could probably easily have a transplant of our histones from soybean or something, it would be absolutely fine. I think there's one amino acid change. Okay, so they're extremely conserved, but it's been shown in yeast and animals that the production of histones is done in a very different way at a regulatory level. There's a really nice study that was done just a couple of years ago on ribosomal protein production and regulation in species of yeast in the same genus. And I point this out because this is important. If you really want to understand evolution, you need to get to a level of close relationships. If you're dealing with things that split 500, 600 million years ago, yeah, they're different, but there have been so many changes upon changes upon changes. You can't reconstruct the original steps. And so it's interesting, even the level of different species in a genus, you can see rather remarkable changes. So that's just something to keep in mind, and one would have to wonder what that would, if that's ever seen in the level of
Mike, back to your other slide. How do proteins that have different amino acid sequences yet function in the same way, have the same higher level structure, how do they fit into your picture here? Because of course, since they have different amino acids, or they might have different amino acids, the code is different for them, yet.
I'm having a hard time. I'm not sure I'm following.
Well, I can substitute amino acids
Okay.
And yet not change the function of...
Of protein.
Protein.
Yeah.
It looks the same if you look at a coarse grain.
Right. Well, there's a lot of that going on. I mean, to... a lot of evolutionary biologists' mind, a lot of amino acid substitutions. This actually relates quite nicely to what Dave was talking about yesterday. A lot of what we think happens at the protein level just happens because it is, in fact, neutral. The amino acid substitution has no, it does not have a significant enough effect on the protein's function for natural selection to be able to see it and keep it constant. Histones is a dramatic example of, you just can't touch almost anything with a histone. Okay, so that's the general argument with protein evolution, is those that evolve more rapidly, it's because there's a smaller fraction of sites that are really functionally important. We can definitely debate on that one. Okay, so let's see, where were we? Okay, so this, I think, provides an interesting defense for the possible development of an evolutionary cell biology. So returning this question, how much of cellular evolution is really focused on adaptive response to challenges from the external environment, the regime of almost all evolutionary biology, as opposed to internal genomic constraints and threats from things like intron and mobile element colonization? I just have a quick list here, things to think about. The spliceosome. I put spliceosomes here because it turns out that there are two kinds of introns to be spliced out in many organisms. Some of us have lost one of the spliceosomes. This is a very, very complex machine. There's five small RNAs at the heart of this. It's at the level of complexity of the ribosome. About 100 proteins are involved. All of this is there to splice introns out of our genes. Why do we even have introns? This is another big question in evolutionary biology. Introns are pretty harmful, as I pointed out in a talk a couple of weeks ago. 10% of human mortality is due to mutations that affect splicing. So it's not a trivial issue. But we got colonized by introns very early. The ancestral eukaryote had introns. That puts a new constraint on evolution of aspects of the cell that wasn't there before. You have to have a spliceosome to get rid of your introns. Giardia is a good example. Giardia has been able to lose all but two introns in the whole genome. It's down to two introns, but it has to maintain this huge molecular machine, they're in key genes, just to splice out those two introns. The nuclear envelope and the nuclear pores. You know, why do we have a nuclear envelope? Eugene Koonin and Bill Martin have argued, well, we have the nuclear envelope because introns colonized, and we had to defend ourselves against introns. We had to produce a barrier so that we could take our pre-mRNAs, splice out the introns before they met the ribosome. Maybe. But, you know, the nuclear envelope's a pretty complicated thing, and an alternative view might be that for other reasons, the nuclear envelope evolved initially, and that made it easier for introns to colonize the nuclear genome. It was a more permissive environment, right? You've already got this barrier between transcription and translation. So what's cause and what's effect? We have a whole bunch of messenger RNA surveillance mechanisms that have been discovered over the past few years. One's called nonsense-mediated decay. This is a molecular mechanism that allows the cell to figure out if it's got a screwed up transcript with a premature stop code on it. And I won't go through the details of this, but often we make screwed up transcripts because we get intron splicing wrong. The intron gets left in or gets spliced at the wrong junction. You get a premature stop code on. How does the cell know whether it's the right stop when it comes to a stop or the wrong stop? Well, I won't go through the details, but there's a neat mechanism to do it. It's called nonsense-mediated decay. Most of us eukaryotes have this mechanism. A few don't, and the few, as far as we can tell, and the few that do not have lost it, and they've lost almost all their introns. So again, it seems as though introns were the evolutionary pressure for the emergence of NMD. What about the evolution of multimeric proteins? A lot of you guys work on proteins. And if you just sit and you don't work on proteins, I guess you could be pretty naive and think about, you know, designing a protein that could just be a monomeric protein. But there are many, many multimeric proteins. Many of them are homomers, and many of them are dimers. Now, why did that happen? Why are many of our proteins so complicated? One possibility is that over time, in us big things, natural selection was ineffective with respect to random genetic drift. Individual proteins became incapacitated a little bit. That means you have to have aggregations of partners to do a task that you might have otherwise been able to do by yourself. I'm working with a guy named Ariel Fernandez at Rice University on this very problem, and he's found that proteins tend to be more what he calls unwrapped in big multicellular organisms than they are in unicellular than in prokaryotic species. I won't go through what all that means, but it means mainly that the core of the protein is more exposed to interactions with, they're sticky, more exposed to interactions with other proteins. That then provides the context for this kind of evolution.
Are you talking about the cytoplasmic multimeric proteins?
I'm just talking in very general terms.
Because I think one of the key evolutionary drives for multimeric proteins was an oxidative environment and the creation of the luminal compartments that are oxidizing, mm-hmm. which drive disulfide bond formation, because most of these multimeric proteins are disulfide bonded.
Okay. Well, that's the kind of connection that you're saying that without that internal cellular environment, you wouldn't have the driving, you wouldn't have the environmental context in some sense.
So eukaryotes really are much more populated by multimeric proteins in their membranes, in their bilayers, what they're secreting, because those proteins are being made in this unique environment of the lumen of the ER, which is highly oxidizing, that can drive disulfide bonded bond formation, which allows you to bring proteins together. Eukaryotes don't have an oxidizing environment anymore. I mean, okay. Prokaryotes don't have an oxidizing environment. So they're pretty much limited to just monomeric character. Because most of these multimeric proteins use disulfide bonds
mm-hmm,
to
right.
bond together.
Yeah. Now it's a good point. And it's just a different perspective on this. That's what I'm trying to get across here. What about the evolution of meiosis? Why do we have meiosis and the evolution of sex? Sex is actually, I won't go through the reasons, but sex is actually an evolutionary costly problem. But one problem all of us eukaryotes have, especially of us big eukaryotes, is that most of our genome consists of stuff we'd rather not have there. So about a third of the human genome consists of mobile elements and remnants of mobile elements, internal genomic parasites, big problem that we have. How do you get rid of these? Well, one way you can get rid of them is by sexual reproduction, because by sexual reproduction, you only pass half your genes on to your kid. So the good news is that if you're a kid, you might get the best of all your parental chromosomes. The bad news is you might actually get the worst of them, but that makes natural selection more efficient. It expands the range of variation in fitness. So meiosis may very well have evolved because of the emergence of transposable elements. And what happens when you get meiosis? Then you have the opportunities for other kinds of intracellular changes. What about the evolution of centromeres? Why do we have centromeres on our chromosomes? Not all of us actually do. But land plants and animals have a peculiar kind of meiosis where in females, I think this is true in all land plants, only one of the four meiotic products gets to play the game, gets to go on to the next generation. This opens up an enormous opportunity for any centromere that can figure out how to get into the correct one of those four meiotic products. So this can lead to the drive, evolution of what we call driving centromeres. And then this can lead to problems in males where every haploid product gets to be a gamete. And then you can think of some co-evolutionary drive that sort of calms down this driving centromere. Just some ideas I want to get out there in terms of things that are going on. The point here is there are things that are going on only internal to cells that can drive the evolution of cellular architecture. It's not all external stuff. Okay, what about the theoretical starting points? Well, cells are complicated things, and so we need to think about complex adaptations, especially if you're talking about a multi-subunit protein, not just single amino acid changes, but there are multiple changes, sometimes in multiple proteins. The good news is we now have models for these kinds of things, and Daniel Weissman just gave a talk on this the other day, and I've talked about it a little bit a week or so ago. And these are pretty powerful models, I think, in the sense that in a population genetic context, and they tell us what can and cannot happen in environments with particular mutation rates, recombination rates, and power of random genetic drift. The other good...
I think like powerful might be overselling what I was talking about a little bit. You know,
okay, well,
we're doing, we've got so far to go, you know.
Well, I wouldn't argue with that, but what's really remarkable, the advances that have been made just in the past couple years, sort of independently by three or four different groups. I didn't even know about Daniel's work until I got here and realized we had converged on fairly similar results. This is a difficult area because there are what we call multi-dimensional diffusion processes. I think this is kind of stuff would get physicists excited, but gets biologists kind of shaky. The math is really difficult, and yet we seem to have discovered some simple solutions, simple ways to the final solution over the past few years. We also have some pretty sophisticated models of the evolution of duplicate genes. This is going on all the time inside cells. For example, we think the flagellum arose due to a series of gene duplications. The main point I'm trying to make is we have a lot of theory already built and ready to go if we knew how to apply it to particular problems. A lot of cells, of course, is about protein-protein interactions and networks, and there's quite a bit of work that's being done on that. Vincent gave a talk about that the other day. I think this should also be put in a population genetic context. And then finally, many of you know my emphasis is that we really need some null models for how evolution proceeds. Before trying to explain all of biodiversity, including inside a cell, based on the external environment, we need to know what you'd expect if external forces weren't driving patterns of evolution. And at the level of molecular, in particular genome evolution, I think we now have some pretty good models for that, and they've been very, very difficult to reject.
Wait, you mean without selection, I mean, we know nothing happens, right? You don't get anything.
I'm talking about, I want to make a distinction between selection from the external environment and selection internally. So introns, for example, are dangerous things to have inside your gene. If you've got an intron, you've got a higher mutation rate to a defective allele because there's sites for splicing that you can't touch. These could be sites in the nucleotide sequence that otherwise, silent sites, that you otherwise could mutate. So there is selection in these null models. They aren't neutral models. They're null models where the forces of selection are due to differences in the mutability of alleles with different architectures. So they're not, I really want to emphasize, they're not neutral models at all.
Is there a theory for how these introns came into the cellular environment?
There's only one credible hypothesis at this point. The idea is that this is one of the big mysteries. My lab's doing some work on this problem today. We know where new introns are coming from.
Where?
They're accidents. We think they come from double strand breaks. And we know that because we got very lucky, but we've discovered some populations of microcrustacean we work on that's been colonized with many new introns. They're in an early phase, presence-absence. They haven't even gone to fixation in the population. We know they're young. And they come from double strand breaks. Some kind of AT-rich DNA gets stuffed in there. In one case, it's actually a piece of mitochondrial DNA. And we know nuclear genomes pick up mitochondrial DNA. Apparently, just sometimes there's enough there to serve as a signature for the spliceosome to get you off the ground. It's not to say we know they're slightly deleterious, but they are being spliced out. Might not be perfect. The beauty of nonsense media decay is if you screw up on a few splices, the bad messages get cleaned out. So if you're making enough good messages, you can sort of get off the ground. terms of the original origin of introns, the going hypothesis, they came from what was called a group 2 intron. So there are introns found in some bacteria. They're very rare. They're called group 2 introns. It's somewhat of a misnomer because they're usually not inside genes. They're between genes. But they are DNAs that are capable of self-splicing. They can self-splice themselves out at the RNA level. And it turns out they don't need a spliceosome. So this is the problem with the origin of the introns. How did you get to this point where we've got 150,000 introns in this very complex machine? Well, it turns out that self-splicing introns at the level of splicing at the RNA level, they use exactly the same biochemical mechanism that is encouraged by our spliceosome in the small RNAs. So that's the only going idea. They could have come in with the primordial mitochondrion, for example. They could have been transported, and somehow they had to get into the nuclear genome, and we don't even, as you pointed out, we don't even really know where the nuclear genome came from with any certainty. But then you still have a very big scenario to try and complete. How did they then become no longer self-splicing and totally dependent on the spliceosome? There are no group 2 introns whatsoever in the nuclear genomes of eukaryotes. So it's a little bit off the... Well, it's another example, I guess, of what, you know, internal genomic accidents that could have happened that led to the evolution of the...
So for theoretical starting points, I think we really are like so far from being able to really do what we should be able to do for the cellular biologists. Like, there's all these very specific questions, but I mean, even really basic stuff, like, say we found another planet and it had tons of radiation on it, made of uranium, and all the mutation rates are 10 times as big. What are cells going to look like there? Are they going to be more complicated, less complicated, anything? What will life look like? We have no idea. If it turned out that we found out tomorrow that the Earth is actually only 10 million years old, the geologists tell us we did it wrong. Would we just say, okay, we're just going to adjust this constant and we get exactly the same life? That we couldn't say no to that. We have no idea what life should look like after 4 billion years, after 40 billion years. If we found another planet that was exactly like Earth, but 100 times as big or 100 times as small, I mean, can life start there? Would life be totally different? We really don't know. So, I mean, we don't know. We can't tell them, okay, your cell could have something this complicated. Your cells have had time to do this kind, have this many genes, anything like that. So I think we as theorists, we have a long way to go before we can really make a lot of demands on the cellular biologists.
Yeah, I hope I didn't give the impression that I thought there was any hope of explaining exactly what happened.
I thought that was part of the point, that it's not deterministic. At some point, it becomes not deterministic, and so...
A lot of what happened, singular events, right? A lot of, the evolution of multicellularity, it's not a singular event. It complex multicellularity evolved twice. And, we all like to think you have to be a eukaryote for multicellularity to evolve twice. Well, do the math. Take those two multicellular lineages and randomly dropping down into prokaryotes versus eukaryotes. And, you can't reject the null hypothesis.
What was the second? What are the two?
Land plants and us, metazoans.
Okay.
I mean, there's other, I'm talking about high-level multicellularity. There are plenty of actual prokaryotes that are multicellular. The myxobacteria would be one really good example. And so finally, this actually is related to the point that Daniel was just making. So again, I want to emphasize, we don't pretend to have, and I don't imagine we ever will, an evolutionary theory that will make specific predictions about what happens. Evolution is a chance process. But I do think that we will be able to make specific predictions about if you change the sizes of populations. Well, I think I'm already doing this in my own work. Change mutation rates and recombination rates in general, which way things will, what kinds of things will happen in a very general case, but not in a specific case whatsoever, in terms of what kind of proteins or even what kind of protein structure. But you'll certainly be more prone to have a lead alleles and proteins emerge that are more mutational harmful if you have a smaller population size. So I want to finish up by with this point here, and this relates to Dave's really exciting talk yesterday, is that there may be opportunities for actually studying some of these problems at the level of cells, or pseudocells, or whatever you might want to call them. And so I think most of you, I hope most of you saw Dave's talk yesterday and how it's possible to process large numbers of drops with various kinds of things in them and to challenge the variants inside these drops, in which case it was horseradish peroxidase, I think, but you can imagine doing this with anything. And I wanted to remind folks about this in case you weren't aware of it. So the beauty of this, I think, is it's just you're only limited by your own imagination as a community to what kind of experiments might be done. And the beauty of this kind of thing is you can manipulate the population size, the number of droplets. You're varying the power of what we call random genetic drift. You're doing PCR, so you can dial up the level of PCR, the level of mutagenicity you want. You can also encourage recombination to occur during your PCR. So you can manipulate many of the fundamental parameters, well, all of the fundamental parameters that are I call the non-adaptive forces of evolution. And then you can do experiments on this very point. How replicable is evolutionary change? If you were to expose different populations, even with the same starting frequencies of different types, to the exact same stochastic forces of drift, mutation, and recombination, let things run, how often would you get the same result? This is actually, there have been many experiments like this done in the field of RNA world research. So there's a lot of interest in the early stages of life having been RNA-based, not DNA-based. And so you can do these. This is fairly similar conceptually the kind of experiment that Dave was talking about, but this is done at the RNA level. And I like the microfluidics approach because it brings you more into a realm of being able to do things with DNA and proteins in particular. So now you're getting at the phenotypic level. But you can select for RNAs that have a phenotype. So this is just one example. This actually was done in one of your colleagues' labs, Jack Shostak's lab, and many other labs have been involved in this. But you make a mixed population of RNA molecules, incredibly mixed population, and then you challenge them to figure out how to do something. In this case, it was to go through a Cepidex column, latch on to something in this column. I've forgotten exactly what it is, but they have to bind with ATP. And then the losers just wash out of the tube, and the guys that do what they're supposed to do are retained in the tube. Then you can get rid of them. You can do reverse transcriptase, turn them back into DNAs. Now that's your natural selection. And then you turn them back into a new population of RNAs, very large populations, but you could dial it down to as small as you want. You could do it mutagenic, and you just keep doing this over and over and over again. And then you look, then you sequence your final products, and in this experiment, you get things like this. And so this is just an example, I think, of getting at this problem, is how replicable is evolution. So there are many, with this particular study, there are many, many replicates, and you always got structures that look like this. So this is just a very simple evolutionary challenge to just bind to ATP in these columns. But if you take a close look at these, they certainly, you don't have to take a close look. They're not identical. But they're very, very similar in many, many ways. So it's not deterministic outcome of evolution, but even, they both got this bubble here and a loop over here, and even this bubble here, there's an AAGAAACU, the same thing you've got there. So I'm just saying that there's a platform for experimental evolution here with proteins now that people might want to think about taking advantage of. That just isn't available if you're studying your favorite fish or your favorite you know, red deer, you know, in Wales or wherever it is. You can't, there's not that level of experimental power that you would have for cell biology and looking for emergence of particular proteins. And I think this would finally allow us to start to answer the question, how deterministic is evolution? How much occurs is in fact neutral? You know, these very general questions that we've been grasping for a very long period of time. So that, I think I went, must have gone more than 15 minutes. But Michael asked me to sort of outline this to sort of bring us back to focus on why we're here. And I think the number of people in the room who probably just got here today. And I guess the idea here is to remind you it's about, it's not just about cell biology and all the beautiful intricacies of the cell, but we're trying to understand how those intricacies evolved. And it's a big job.
Thanks. Nothing's wrong. See what's that?